Please note, touch tone commands are now preceded by the star key. For example, to mute or unmute yourself, press star 6. Please announce yourself.
Hello?
Is there an echo? I don't hear
an echo.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes, I do.
Hello?
Hello?
This is Ellie.
This is Holden, but Peter's not here yet.
All right. Well, that's okay. So I think Pressum is gonna run us into another of normal issues. And I think before we contact them, I might just ask Lindy if she knows the answers to my questions.
Okay.
And it's basically just going to be, they list, you know, like 6 programs or something. 2 of them, maybe 3 of them. It's kind of hard to tell based on the program definition, have been evaluated by J-PAL. And then there's just this question of how big they are. There's like some evidence that they're like the main thing they do is the programs that have been evaluated. And that along with Rachel saying, we really...
Hi, this is Peter Singer.
Hi, Peter. It's Holden and Ellie.
Hi, good.
I'm doing well.
Hey.
Hi. Hey.
So I thought first I would just give you a real broad overview of just what we've been doing, what our strategy has been and is going to be. And then I thought I would also talk about, I mean, at this point we've taken at least kind of a cursory look at a whole lot of charities, including the ones that kind of are in your book and on your website. So, you know, I thought I would kind of address those also.
Great.
Yeah, cool. All right, so basically, and first off, I don't think I ever got to, I never got to come to your book signing, but I wanted to just congratulate you on the book and all the publicity and also just the good work. So.
Good. Well, I hope as well as obviously helping the cause in general, I hope it does direct a bit more attention towards GiveWell.
Yeah, well, okay, so just a real general overview. I mean, we kind of, you know, I looked over the academic literature on a lot of kind of the questions that a donor would want to ask. I mean, without trying to read every paper or anything like that, just trying to kind of, you know, read literature reviews and see what's out there on kind of basic questions like, you know, what's the argument that aid does more harm than good? Does aid usually succeed? Is it usually even measured? So that was kind of one major focus of our research for a while. And a couple of the main themes that we've come out with is one that there are a lot of calls for more measurement than there is, and almost no one seems to disagree that more measurement is needed. And so a large part of like the situation with international aid is that no one really knows what's happening, at least not as much as they would like to. And even kind of the Paris Declaration on Aid Effectiveness, which was signed by like every single agency in the world, was expressing a concern about this and saying, you know, we need more. So I mean, that's one of the frustrating things. You know, but getting beyond that, I think that it does look like, you know, there have been some really big success stories in the area of health specifically. And in areas outside of health, the picture is a lot muddier and a lot less encouraging. And then that may have something to do with the fact that it is kind of, I've seen William Eastman make this claim for sure, that it is kind of easier to hold an agency accountable when it's doing something sort of concrete and measurable, like trying to reduce the prevalence of a disease. Whereas these more ambitious attempts to kind of, you know, fix a whole country at once, or, you know, or even, I mean, even less ambitious, but just trying to deal with people's job skills and economies, things that we ultimately know very little about, there just isn't a lot of encouraging track record out there. It doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means if we're looking for something to recommend to individual donors and we want it to be something kind of reliable and something you can have confidence in without checking it out yourself, you know, one of the things that we've really been learning and one of the major themes that health is kind of one of the big areas to focus on. And I think it partly explains, too, our frustrations last year because we had a lot of trouble getting information on what's going on in any of these microfinance organizations or agricultural support. And as we look at it a little bit better, I think it's largely because there's just not so much information out there, period. And even in the world of academia, it's just very rare that that people are really finding, you know, good evidence of success of these kind of projects. So we're not giving up, and we actually, you know, we have a good amount of money earmarked in that area, so we're going to have to make sure to find someone at least decent in that area, but it's, you know, it's kind of healthy where we're at. So that's the first kind of area. And then what we've done, you know, another thing that we've done is kind of with those general principles in mind. We have a list of things that have worked. We have a list of things that are recommended by experts, such as the Copenhagen Consensus. And what we've done is we've kind of gone through hundreds of charities and asked two basic questions and seen if we could answer them from their websites. And one of them is, you know, does this charity mostly do things that have a good track record or things that are recommended? And so if we see a charity that appears very focused and it's, you know, focused on things that have a good track record, which are mostly health interventions, they get kind of a flag. And then we also ask another question, which is, does this charity freely make available the information you would need to determine whether its activities are being carried out and having the intended effects? And so that would be kind of the monitoring and evaluation question. And really, a charity that can say yes to either of those questions, doesn't have to be both, gets flagged for another look. And then we go in and, you know, really take a look around their website and see what's out there and try and make a more like, okay, here's the information that we can't find that we would need in order to really be confident that this stuff is happening as it's supposed to. And so now we're kind of at the stage where we've taken a quick look at almost everyone. We have probably, you know, I don't know, 12 top contenders where we have some questions and we're trying to get in touch with them now to get those questions answered. Ellie, is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, the quick numbers, you know, we looked at about 350 charities' websites. Of those, 50 met, you know, some of the criteria that Holden met said before in one way or another. And of those, there are maybe 20 that are, you know, we've sort of that have filtered to the top because of the, you know, degree of preference in an intervention or the degree of monitoring on their website. And those are ones that we've either started to look at in depth and write up, you know, so we publish a review of the Stop TB partnership, which met both those criteria, so that we really like them. And then others who might be doing a great intervention but don't have the information, we've tried to get in touch with. But by and large, the you know, what we found last year is what we found again this year, which is you go to a charity's website and you're not going to find a type of information that's going to give you confidence that you can just give them money and you're making a difference.
Right. And so where we are now is we're still kind of working on two fronts. You know, on one hand, we're doing these in-depth investigations of the most promising charities. And on the other side, you know, still trying to check our basic picture of aid. And is this, you know, is this kind of story reasonable? You know, is it reasonable to go about things in this way, to put a high emphasis on measurement and all this stuff? And so on that second front, you know, a lot of what I've done the reading I'm going to do largely. And I'm kind of a combination of writing it up and trying to get in touch with more people who can really give me sort of, you know, meaningful feedback on the conclusions and on the literature. So that's kind of the two things we're working on. And so we can go into a little more detail, I think, on the specific charities, but wanted to hear your thoughts on that first.
Yeah, okay. Well, that certainly sounds pretty good. Yeah, I think the big issue is going to be very difficult. And I mean, I suppose it's such a large question, and it's hard to answer, especially with so much aid is government aid or, you know, World Bank multilateral aid. And if you really focus on NGO aid, I guess they do a whole lot of different things, and they don't. Some of them work and some of them don't work. And I'm not sure whether you can get a general answer to the question, or whether you just have to look at specific things and say, well, eventually we'll build up knowledge as to what does work, and then we'll be able to do more of that and less of the other stuff.
So, actually, before I ask for clarification, I forgot to ask you, is it okay with you if we record this call? And, you know, I think before we posted anything, we would run it by you, but it just makes things easier for us in terms of note-taking.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, you can record it. And you think you're posting it on the website then, as a transcript of it, or what?
I wouldn't, I would prefer to post the whole recording on the website. That's how we always prefer to do everything. But I wouldn't just do that. Right now, all I'm asking for is, you know, permission to record the call internally, and then we'll kind of decide later, but might post edited notes. If it's okay with you and you feel comfortable, we would post all the audio, or we could, you know, remove parts of it that you wanted to remove.
Yeah, okay. I mean, while I share your concern about transparency, obviously, if I know that you're going to post the entire audio, it may alter the way I put something.
Yeah. Let's assume that nothing's going to get posted without us explicitly running it by you. So let's all talk is not being recorded, and as though this is never going to get out, and we won't post it unless we, you know, I think if we decided to post audio, we would make sure to, like, you know, declare everything with you first. But I think it's also very likely that we will never post the audio. That we'll just take some notes down from it and run those by you.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. All right. So So I mean, because I had the recorder on from the beginning of this call. I just wanted to let you know that, and I just forgot to ask it at the beginning. Okay. Just moving on. So what you were just saying, you're saying this is kind of a, I'm not sure I quite followed. And then I disturbed the flow with the recording thing. But I wasn't quite sure I followed what you said. But it sounds like you're kind of saying, you know, the question of what works in general is very hard to answer, and you may have to stick with the specific charities in order to get a meaningful answer to that question. Is that what you were saying?
No, it wasn't a question of what works in general. I thought you were looking at the question as to whether aid works in general. That is, what if you're talking about getting a basic picture of aid, and of course you do need a basic picture of aid. But to answer a question like, does aid work, is an extremely general question.
Well, I think our conclusion to that question would be, sometimes it does wonderful things and sometimes it fails miserably, and that might sound just like a totally obvious cop-out, but the fact is that most people, when they give to charity, are not going in with that mentality whatsoever. And so just to be able to make that point, that sometimes aid goes wonderfully and sometimes it goes horribly, I think is huge and really is, might kind of sound obvious as we're sitting here talking about it or if you've read the literature, but I think most donors don't have that mentality at all. Their default assumption about any charity is that they're doing good, and I don't think that that's a safe assumption.
Right. Okay. Good.
Yeah. So I guess I would like to just address. I would like to sort of list the couple of charities that have really stood out to us, and then also address the ones that you list and what we think about those, and the overlap is there's somewhat of it, but the biggest charity, I mean, the one I'm certainly most excited about and most impressed with is actually a global health partnership called the Stop Tuberculosis Partnership. And, they're run out of the World Health Organization, so it's kind of a big alliance-type initiative. But what impressed us about them is that you go to their website, and, I mean, a few things just jump out. First off, tuberculosis control is one of the top things you could be doing, according to almost anyone, you know, who's really comparing interventions. And so, you know, it's rated as a highly cost-effective way to save lives. It's also adult lives that it often saves, which is particularly meaningful. You know, you could be talking about a caregiver, someone in the prime of their life taken down by TB, and that's not true of a lot of these other diseases, primarily affect infants. So, you know, it's a great cause. The intervention, the directly observed therapy short course, has a, you know, several large-scale success stories. It's also, you know, medically rigorously proven to work. It's also considered one of the most cost-effective interventions there is, and in fact, when the Copenhagen Consensus paper authors wrote their most recent paper on disease intervention, they ranked this intervention number one out of all health interventions as far as where a donor should put his dollars. So right off the bat, we're talking about a good problem we're working on and a good way to be working on that problem. And then you look at the organization, and we haven't even, Ellie, have we even gotten in touch with them yet?
No, we've never talked to them.
We've never talked to them. And we already have, I mean, pretty much all the information we need to be confident. I mean, they're so transparent, and it's all right out there. You know, basically, they've got most of their funds are going into this global drug facility where they purchase drugs needed for tuberculosis treatment, and then they get them to governments, and as a condition of receiving those drugs, the governments, you know, have to comply with these regulations intended to make sure that they're implementing the WHO-recommended tuberculosis control strategy. And then they send in these external auditors to spot check and to see if that's happening. And we even, this is pretty unusual, found evidence that sometimes the country will lose funding as a result of that process, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is a big deal. A lot of these funders are kind of notorious for not holding governments accountable, for continuing to fund them every year, no matter what they do. And so when you look at this, you can see all the reports, and you can see, okay, here's where the money went. I bought drugs. The drugs went to these governments. The governments were monitored in this way. These ones complied. These ones didn't. And bottom line, you know, you have an unusual degree of documentation and transparency that really, you know, really makes us feel better about what that money's doing, where it's going, and it is, in fact, going to one of the most cost-effective ways to save lives. So kind of, you know, really quite an exceptional option for donors in terms of the confidence, in terms of the cost-effectiveness, in terms of just about everything. And so we, you know, we recommend, we still have to check out a few things, but that's likely to be near the top of our list.
Okay. That's good news. I hadn't heard of that one at all, so that's good to add to the list.
Yeah. So there's them. There's a couple more that we're still working on. There's Village Reach is kind of a small charity, and they kind of work on the last step in the chain to getting vaccines to children. And vaccines are another one of these top interventions that just anywhere you read, people will say, yeah, vaccines have worked on a large scale many times, and they're medically proven, and they're cost-effective. And, you know, rated at something like $300 per life saved is where the Disease Control Priorities Report puts them. And then Village Reach is, again, you know, really providing the convincing documentation that, in fact, this money is getting the vaccines. You know, this money is being used to provide crucial links in the chain that will get vaccines to areas that otherwise wouldn't have had them. So there's those guys. There's Population Services International, one of our existing recommended charities. I mean, they come out very strong on the same metrics we're using. And, you know, they have they also do things that have a good track record, condoms, bed nets, and, again, monitoring all the questions that you would want to see. So those are kind of the ones we're most excited about. We've still got a lot to look into, but those are the ones that jump to the top. And they're all kind of, you know, doing things that have worked before, but also making sure that they're working now. Is that pretty accurate, Ellie?
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay. So those are the guys who jumped out. And then I thought I'd also share some thoughts on some of these charities, you know, that we've talked about before. And I think some of them are on our list as definitely like high potential charities. So they're in that category of, you know, well, there's a good reason to be excited about these guys, but we've got to ask more questions, and we're working on that. And then some of them don't fall in that category. So, you know, start off with Thread Hollows. That's the one that we kind of had the most to say about recently. I sent you our thoughts on that.
Yeah, you sent me an email, which I just read this morning, yeah.
So, I mean, okay, so you did get a chance to read it. So, you know, I guess
basically, you're saying there's still a few questions that need to be answered before you can really make a judgment. Is that fair enough?
I mean, it is and it isn't, because I think that one of the things that we've been finding is that, you know, with almost any charity, it's always going to be true that there's still questions we need to answer. Because, you know, it's really only the exceptional ones where we can answer the questions at all. But we think that the default presumption with a charity should be, not that it isn't good, but certainly that it isn't exceptional. Seems like a pretty fair default assumption. And, you know, basically from what I've seen, there's, again, plenty of horror stories of aid going wrong, plenty of things that don't have great track records. You know, to me, when you give your money to a giant organization, the burden of proof is on the person who would claim that that organization is consistently and reliably and cost-effectively doing good. And an organization that isn't proactively answering those questions, I think the default assumption should be no. It doesn't mean they're doing no good. I think mostly charities do more good than harm in the end. But, you know, I think at this point, it's a question of where your priors are and what your default is. And from everything we've seen and from the cases where things do get measured, I think it's reasonable to have a default position of, you know, these guys are not up there with the other ones in terms of cost effectiveness, reliability, getting the money to the poor. I think that's a good default. And so what we're seeing with Thread Hollows is we push this about as far as we normally push it and haven't seen anything to overturn that default. Now, it could be overturned, and we're still waiting for information. So absolutely, if that guy sends us more stuff and it's encouraging, we will absolutely, you know, promote them, but as far as where I stand now, I would take the position that they're, you know, they have the default assumption on them, and furthermore that, you know, I don't think personally, just as a comment, I don't think that they're a good source for like a cost effectiveness number. I think they're like $1,000 less paid for PSI. I mean, that number, I've got several different reasons to believe that was reasonable, even if there's a lot of uncertainty. The $50 for blindness averted, Thread Hollows, I mean, I believe that number's wrong, and that's where we stand.
Okay, so I guess I didn't get that out of your email. I'm a little puzzled as to why you're saying that. I mean, as I understood your email, it's simply you were saying there wasn't enough information about whether they were, what kind of interventions they were referring to, as to whether the million cases or so were cases where people's sight was restored or blindness was alleviated or not, that you didn't have an answer to that. But if the answer to that was yes, that blindness was alleviated directly by their methods, then it would be highly cost-effective. Isn't that correct?
Well, first off, the cost effectiveness is an entirely different question. So that was, you know, I guess there's two separate questions, and maybe we should take them one at a time, cost effectiveness and effectiveness. So, you know, on the cost effectiveness, I think at this point the cost effectiveness is just a giant question mark. I think that you and I discussed a number earlier that I now believe just doesn't have a basis. And so that, you know, it's based on sort of numbers that don't mean what we thought they meant. And so I think the cost effectiveness should be considered to be the same giant question mark as any other international aid organization. It could be really good. It could be really bad. We truly have no idea. So that's on cost effectiveness. I want to pause there. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm only going by what Toby Ord said, that they're claiming to have restored sight to over 1 million people. And now, if that's true, and if the figures about the total amount of money they have raised ever are true, then they have restored sight to people very cheaply, whether it's $50 or something around that, but it's certainly, you know, not several hundred dollars, because they just haven't raised that much money, right?
Yeah, I don't think... Well, go ahead.
You would have to be saying that figure of interventions that restored sight to 1 million people is false.
Well, I'm saying it's not true as we interpreted it. I think that a lot of charity statistics are sort of, you know, intentionally vague about exactly how they word things. I'm not saying that number's a purposeful or blatant lie, but I'm saying that a lot of these numbers, when you look into them, turn out to be, well, you know, people took a bunch of numbers and then one thing, and then they added them up to get a number, and then another thing, and then it kind of got passed around, and the language got warped from one place to another. So, I mean, I don't want to go as far as saying that someone at Fred Hollows just made up a number. I don't think that's true at all. But I also, at this point, would definitely bet that the number does not mean what we thought it means. That the number is basically the sum of, and this point was made in our email, number is basically the sum of, you know, different things that are all labeled site-saving interventions. And so when you add that up, you have X site-saving interventions, and then maybe someone in marketing takes that and says, oh, we've restored sight to this many people. And, you know, this might sound very cynical, but this would not be anything new. This is the same thing that you see on Nothing But Net. It says, buy a net, save a life. Well, you know, you and I both know that's not how it works, and I don't think anyone's maliciously lying. It's just that that's how it gets marketed, and that's how it gets passed around from one place to another. So site-saving interventions include things like a dose of ivermectin. A dose of ivermectin is simply not the same as sight restored to one person, and the ratio is, I don't know, hundreds to one. Not that ivermectin is not a good thing. It is, but ivermectin costs pennies, and if it were that simple, you know, it would be different.
Right. Okay. So you've asked them to clarify that, I take it, as to how many of the cases of sight saves are things like surgery that restores sight on a specific individual, as against how much is providing vitamin A or giving people a dose of ivermectin. Is that right?
But we have cataract surgeries is one number, and that number is, you know, it's not even half. I think it was, you know, a pretty small part of the total sight-saving interventions. And then the other ones, we do have a list of what they are. So we know that there's a lot of stuff in there that's not, you know, sight restored to a person. And indeed, cataract surgery is also not sight restored to a person, and we made a separate analysis of that. So we know that the number is not what we thought.
Why isn't cataract surgery sight restored to a person?
Well, I mean, a lot of cataracts just aren't. I mean, it just depends on the severity of the cataract. Cataract surgery refers to any surgery on any cataract, and some of them are severe and some of them are mild and some of them are anything in between. So that was the main thing.
There are surgical complications, so not all cataract surgeries are successful.
Right.
Well, that's true, yes.
Right.
Okay.
There's both of those issues.
But from our perspective, one of the main points is that, you know, we've seen this pattern repeatedly with organizations that we've researched where the very top line information seems very promising, and when we dig a little bit deeper and learn more about what the underlying data is, we largely find is that they're unable or maybe unwilling to give us the information about what exactly it is. So I certainly hope that Fred Hollows can break the numbers down in a way that's useful. But I also I wouldn't be surprised if they end up fitting the pattern where we don't get much more information from them at this point, because very often the organizations that have the information tend to make it available or share it relatively early in the process.
Right.
Okay. Are you dealing with which office are you dealing with, by the way?
Australia. In Australia.
You are dealing with the Australian office. Okay. So if you and how long is it now since you last heard back from them, or since you wrote to them, or?
We only wrote up our questions, our specific questions that we emailed you in the last few days, and we just heard back from them. We're still hoping to get more from them.
Okay, so if you would keep me in the loop on that one, since I am in Australia, if you don't hear in a month or so, give me the name of your contact, and I'll give them a call and try and put a bit more pressure on them to come up with stuff, because I certainly have been talking about them, especially here in Australia, and if I shouldn't be, then I need to know that, and I want to let them know that I won't be talking about them in the same way that I have been if they can't provide the figures.
I mean, that's, we will, and we will keep you in the loop. But I mean, again, it's a question of like priors and you know where you stand as a default. And you know, to me it's like yeah, we haven't seen proof that they're we haven't seen any proof that they're ineffective, or that we haven't seen hard proof that they're not converting a blindness for $50. Well, we have, but you know, they for $100 it could be off by only a little bit. But we, you know, if you apply that standard of evidence, that would also apply to every charity in the world. And there's a lot of charities out there that you could take their top line number, and if you didn't look into it, you would say one thing. And so, you know, I guess we sort of are coming from different places on that, where Ellie and I come at this organization, and we don't have any prior reason to believe that they're, you know, exceptional, and so we don't see anything to overturn that. And you're more making the point, well, let's wait till we have the hard proof that they're not. And so that we seem to be coming from different places. I just wanted to make sure to note that.
Okay. I understand that, and I guess it does depend a little bit on you know, what you know about or what you believe about the organization as your starting point. And obviously, that will be different with different organizations.
Right, and with different people. So that seems to be why we seem to be coming from a little different places on them specifically. All right, so moving on. Want to talk about Fistula Foundation. You know.
Sorry, I didn't catch the name.
Fistula Foundation.
Oh, Fistula, yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't have much to say about them. I'm kind of going on the list. I mean, they're considered one of our higher priority charities right now because they're focused. They do something pretty, you know, they kind of do one thing, and it's something that we think is really pretty cost-effective and pretty good and meaningful in the scheme of things. So they're on our list. We've emailed them to set up a time to talk, and, you know, but again, that's where we are in them, is we like the basic idea of what they do, and then we haven't gotten past that. That's the Fistula Foundation.
Right, no. In the book, I talk about two different organizations that do the same kind of work. I don't know if you've been in touch with them both. There's the Fistula Foundation, which is basically based in Ethiopia, and there's the Worldwide Fistula Fund, World Fistula Fund, or something like that. Anyway, I forget.
Yeah, that was going to be the next one. I mean, they're both small organizations, and they're both like, you know, they're talking about a small amount of money for both, and in both cases, we would be a little concerned about promoting them too much, because, you know, the question is money going to come in faster than they can make good use of it? But there is a difference, which is that the Fistula Foundation appears to be kind of, you know, focused on doing one thing in one place, and so therefore, you know, it seems more likely that, well, okay, there's the overfunding issue, and then there's also the issue of, like, you know, do they have the scale to be able to kind of document themselves and meet this kind of standard proof that we talk about that we wouldn't want to impose on every charity in the world, but we would want to impose on a charity before we went and recommended them to a whole bunch of people who've never heard of them. And so we think there's a good chance the Fistula Foundation can meet that, because even though they're small, they're kind of doing one thing in one place, and they might have the data on what they're doing to meet that standard. The Worldwide Fistula Fund, we think, is less likely. Their 2,000 expenses were something like $177,000, and yet they're doing a huge variety of, you know, funding different things in different places. And so, you know, we might contact them, but they're much less likely to be someone we feel comfortable recommending to individuals. Is that about right, Ellie?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. So those are...
That makes sense.
Yeah, those are those two. Then we've got Millennium Villages. Okay, so Millennium Villages, I think, that was another one that was initially very high on our list. I think we were coming from the same place as you, thinking, all right, if you can come into a village and turn it around so it doesn't need support anymore and kind of address all the problems at once that donors can usefully address, that would be great. A couple things have made us pause. One is just that... Like, I talked to the people at the PRI, which is William Easterly's current organization, and they were kind of down on the whole idea, which surprised me. But it had a lot to do
Who are these people on the
name? Diane Bennett is the executive director of DRI, and Laura Freshy were the ones I met with. And I think they were largely, relaying the opinion of Professor Easterly, who I've seen him, you know, kind of say negative things about this idea. You know, the basic vibe I got, and this is a lot of this is informal. You know, one is that there's some concerns about what happens when you go into one village and pump it up so much and so prominently that people from other villages are going to start wanting to move there, and the government feels pressure to kind of match those funds in other villages, and then all of a sudden you're interfering with government priorities. I mean, that was one of the concerns that was raised about this kind of, you know, super highly intensive thing. And I think that's kind of the Potemkin village's criticism. It's just that it's so top-down and it's so kind of, you know, it's so intense like that and publicized that you've got some potentially unanticipated effects. And I think they have dealt with some of that issue. And then the other issue is just more like, you know, the issue of kind of prescribing a set of interventions for a whole bunch of villages at once rather than having a more bottom-up process creates questions. And so, you know, I just kind of got a, you know, there's a question about they had these ambitions to be doing a certain amount of things, and it seems like they've already kind of, this is something I got informally from Diane and haven't checked out that much, but that they've already had to change course a couple times, and what they're going to be doing, what they're going to be doing, and I don't have much more details on that. Because what we were really interested in was more checking out the, you know, have they gotten to the point yet where they've kind of launched a village? And at this point, I mean, there's not even, it doesn't mean there won't be later. At this point, there's not even sort of the data to confidently say they're improving lives. They just kind of have baseline data. And so I actually, they seem very dedicated and very serious about measurement. And so it's very possible that in a few years we'll be recommending them. But we see them as kind of like an experiment in progress of something that, you know, has been tried in similar form, if not identical form, in the past, and they kind of even acknowledge this on their website and not worked out so well. So it doesn't mean it's not going to work, but it seems to me, again, more appropriate to think of these guys as an experiment, which I think is how you presented them and, you know, how we think of them, and less as, again, you know, the ones I would feel comfortable saying to all these individual donors give here.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. We need a few more years yet, but it's in, you know, it is encouraging that they're interested in measuring, that they're taking baseline data and so on. Yeah.
It is, and I think they're really out there to answer the skeptics, and it'll be really interesting to see what happens because it would be great if they could do it. And then finally, you know, UNICEF and Oxfam are both just, they're just giant organizations. They have incredibly diverse activities. We kind of don't even, in a sense, don't even know where to begin. I mean, where we want to begin is asking them to help us understand what they do. And I don't think it's a totally unreasonable question. I mean, I think that there are a couple giant organizations that still are transparent enough and understandable enough to evaluate. So that, you know, the Carter Center is kind of close to that standard where they do a lot of things, but, you know, they also post a lot of documents. UNICEF and Oxfam and most giant organizations, it's just they have a huge number of activities. The activities are all over the map. There are some things that have worked, some things that have not worked. And you can't even, you know, there's so little information on the website, so you can't even get like a breakdown of expenses of that program. And then you talk to the representatives and, you know, a lot of times certainly with these two, I mean, the representatives have not, when we say we want to see the bird's eye view, we want to see what your organization does as a whole, representatives have kind of said, well, that's not available, we're not going to give that to you, and or it doesn't exist. So that's where we are with them. I know that you're very close with Oxfam, and so, I mean, I wonder if you have any ideas on how to get a better picture of them or just how to even attack an organization that combines size with kind of at least lack of public documentation in that way.
Yeah, but I'm wondering whether, in a way, what you're doing is the right approach, because, as you say, they are big organizations, and there's no need for donors to simply give a donation to Oxfam and say, use it as you see fit. I mean, obviously, you can do that, and probably most people do that, but if you want to, you can say, show me some of the projects you're working on,
right?
And let me decide what to support, which is what I tend to do. So another approach might be to say, you know, since they are so big and since you're comparing them with much smaller organizations, to say, well, show me some of the things that you do that you have got good evaluative data on it working.
Yep.
And then these are things that we could recommend rather than simply recommending a generic donation to Oxfam. Is that possible?
It might be, and it's something we've talked about a lot, so I want to go into that a little bit more. There's a couple things that has stopped us from doing that to this point, although we might do it, because I think the arguments you raised are perfectly valid. There's a couple issues. One is we're concerned about how meaningful it really is to restrict your donation, especially to one of these really huge organizations that most of its funds are coming in unrestricted. So we've gotten different stories on this from different people, and I think the answer is different for different organizations. But certainly there's at least a concern that when you give to Oxfam, what's really when you say use it for Project X, what's really happening is that they were going to spend a certain amount on Project X anyway, and they just reallocate their unrestricted funds from Project X to whatever it is else they want to do. And so the whole idea that you're giving to Project X is kind of an illusion, and you're ultimately funding Oxfam's priorities anyway, but you can't really tell what those are. And some people that we've talked to said that's not how it works. If you give to a charity for a project, they'll use it for that. Other people have said that's actually how it works. And you can only give to an organization that you trust the whole thing. And so we've gotten both stories. We don't know which is true when. I would guess that the more of a charity's funds are coming in unrestricted, the more of a concern that is. And so that's one concern. Another concern is just methodologically for us is, if we start going, show us one project, then we've got a whole issue of where we'll be, our ratings of charities will depend so heavily on their development officer and that person's grasp of what we're going for and that person's guess as to what kind of program is going to meet our criteria, and that really starts to get pretty arbitrary in my opinion. And so for both of those reasons, so far we've said, look, we just feel less arbitrary, more comfortable, more confident when we can feel comfortable with the whole organization. There's not a lot of organizations we can feel comfortable about, but as long as there are some, why wouldn't you give to those? And that's kind of what we've done so far. But, I mean, the project...
Yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah.
There's strong...
Yeah, I can understand that from your point of view, but yes, if you get into looking at specific projects for one organization, you can't refuse to do it for others, and it does complicate the whole story of what you're trying to do.
Right. So maybe with Oxfam, this is just a really interesting, to me, an interesting case study, because most of these big charities, we almost have to just throw up our hands, but you are closer to that organization. I wonder, if you could think about, just think about the reasons that you have confidence in them and how those reasons could be expressed in a way that would be, credible to large numbers of people and not rely on trust in a particular personality. I don't know. That's about all I got, so I'm going to put that out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll think about that and maybe talk to some people there.
Yeah.
About what can be done about that.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think I'll probably leave it at that. You understand the challenge and the hurdle that we face in trying to have a certain standard of evidence, and how can we get Oxfam to go up against that standard. So I would leave it to you from there. And
yeah. Do you know who you've been talking to there?
What did you say?
Do you have the name of the people you have been talking to there?
We've had really limited contact there because the two interactions that I know we've had, I don't think Ellie emailed them this year, but I know that when we were a volunteer project, we just called them and said, can we have this information, that information? They were just all our reports are internal. We're not sharing them with anyone. And then when we did them in year one, I remember sending them a grant application, and they came back nope, grant isn't big enough. We would apply for, it was either $100,000 or $200,000 grant, but we're not spending any time on you for this. I mean, they've shut us out pretty hard. We haven't. We don't have much. We have nothing to go from. I think starting from scratch would be
Okay, so we're starting from scratch, really. All right, so I'll make some inquiries, and it might take a while, but I will pursue that.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the one other issue I was going to raise is just that one of the things that we're trying to do on the other side, on the academic literature and on the general issues side, is we want as much feedback as we can get. We want to talk to good people. And we've had a little trouble doing that. I think a lot of these academics that we contact, some of them we've gotten and some of them we've talked to, but a lot of them have, you know, just been busy, been impossible to reach, been impossible to schedule. So I don't really know what we can do about that. I know that, you know, one I wanted to just definitely mention is, you know, William Easterly is a guy we want to talk to. We've talked to the people he works with. We've talked to his organization. Haven't been able to get an audience with him. And, you know, he makes so many good arguments and does such good analysis directly on the issues that we're into that, you know, I think that it would be good. So I don't know. I wanted to just raise that and see if you might be able to help, might have any ideas for how to get in touch with.
Sure, I can contact him and try and get him to make time to talk to you. Yeah, I have no problem with that. He is busy, no doubt, but he should have time to talk to you. Yeah. I mean, obviously, as you know, if you're talking to him about, he mentioned his opinions of the Millennium Villages, I mean, there is a fair amount of hostility between him and Jeffrey Sachs.
Yeah, so, I do understand that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's actually very good to keep in mind, yeah.
Yeah. He's definitely worth talking to, and I will see what I can do about getting him to make time for you.
Yeah, that'd be, I guess nothing else jumps to mind that I probably need to cover. I mean, I've given you the overview and what are intermediate conclusions. Ellie, is there anything I'm missing?
No, right. I think you covered it.
All right. Well, do you have any other questions?
Not exactly. I mean, I now have a kind of methodological problem of my own in that, as you know, if you've looked at the book's website, I've put on it a list of the organizations that I mentioned in the book for people to give to, which, you know, you've rightly said there's some doubts about that list. But I also said you're welcome to recommend other organizations, and a lot of people have done that. So there's now another page with organizations recommended by readers, right, which I haven't endorsed, but at some stage I would really like for someone anyway, I don't know if it can be me, to go through them and say, well, are there any ones here that we recommend or some that we positively don't want to recommend and so on. And I'm not quite sure how to get that job done. I mean, I know that you guys will be pretty flat out, but what it really shows, I guess, is that we need to try and recruit more people who are using the sort of methods that you're using to assess organizations.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, what I would say, you know, basically, I just noticed that list today. We can add that list to our list, no problem. But it's just important to understand what that means, which is that, you know, we take the 5-minute look and we ask two key questions. Are they focused on things that, you know, that experts recommend and that have worked? And two, do they freely and publicly make certain information available? And if those questions come up no, we move on. And so,
right.
You know, and then we go from there. And, you know, I think you're very familiar with the good and bad about our approach. So, you know, we're trying to find the exceptional ones we can have confidence in. We end up saying about a lot of charities, well, we don't really know, but our default assumption should be, you know, that they're okay, but that they're not as good as these other ones. You know, that's us. And so we can cover them at that level, and we will. And then as far as, you know, if you find that approach unsatisfactory, I wish there were other GiveWells that had, because we've got our worldview and our biases and our sort of beliefs about what constitutes evidence, and people disagree, but that's one thing we can't reasonably do, you know. We can't, like, apply some standard of evidence we don't believe in. So we have what we think are the best. We have our opinions on everyone else, which are based on limited evidence. We don't waste a lot of time looking into organizations that don't stand out because we don't have the resources. And there could be more groups like us that had different worldviews and different evidence standards, and I wish there were. So that's the two-part answer, that we will and we can and will cover those organizations in the way that we cover. And then if you're looking for more perspectives, I mean, that's just a challenge of creating more demand for this kind of service.
Yeah, great. Okay. So that's a help anyway. So, you know, let me know when you do come up with any results, particularly obviously if you come up with any positive results on any of them, but whatever results you do come up with, and I'll see if I can find anyone else who wants to do some work as well.
It might be good, just as a minor thing, it might be good to set up that page so that we get alerted somehow when someone adds a new one. just so we don't, like, go back and check it all the time. I don't know if there's an RSS. You can set up the email us. I don't know. You want to check into that. That'd be good.
I'll check into whether that can be done.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Great. Right. Anything else?
I can't think of anything else at the moment.
Okay, great. Well, good talking to you. Thanks again for, you know, all your help and good work, and let us know if you have any other questions.
Sure. All right. Good to talk to you, too. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.